You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to the Anarchist World This Week, broadcast across Australia via the Community Radio Network. This program is coming to you from the studios of 3CR in Melbourne. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. Look, this is a special program. I'm away this week, so it's a pre-record. There'll be no analysis of what's happening in the world. Who knows? The world could have ended since I've did this pre-record a few days ago, but I'm having a week off. Now, if you wonder what anarchy is all about, anarchos, without rulers, not without rules, without rulers. What gives rulers the ability to determine the lives of billions of people? Inequalities in power and wealth. What is the anarchist struggle? The anarchist struggle is the struggle to hold wealth in common and use it for the common good. And it's the struggle to devolve power, possibly through direct democratic means. Now, people like to think of anarchists as, you know, as causing chaos. You want chaos? Just go on social media. Look at the legacy media and you'll know what chaos is all about. It's when we have rulers who think that they and they alone have the answer to everything. All right, today I'm going to talk about something which is a little bit like the air, the oxygen we breathe, but something we're really not aware of. You know, we're not aware of the oxygen we breathe unless somebody turns off the oxygen, then within a few minutes, we know we're in big trouble because we'll drop dead. And it's the same with the Australian Constitution. It's there in the background. But somehow most of us, or most people, I won't say most of us, but most people are unaware of its existence, let alone the profound impact it has on everyday life. So I'd like to look at the Australian Constitution historically and in 2025. Because considering the radical program behind the Australian Constitution and how something which could have been so forward-looking is a statement which is devoid, has no explicit values, aspirations or rights. And I'll say that again, because you may find that hard to believe. Because a lot of people in this country think they have rights, they have values, and somehow there's some piece of paper that protects them from the arbitrary exercise of state power. And I'll say it again. The Australian Constitution, which is the document which basically regulates the type of society we are, how we're structured, is a statement with no explicit value, aspirations or rights. No explicit values, aspirations or rights. How could this be so? Professor Julian Sumner the Miller used to say, you know, when he was trying to explain some basic scientific fact. How, not that facts matter in 2025, you just create the ones you want to. How could this be so? Well, let's go back to the very beginning of colonisation. Because we need to go back to the beginning of colonisation to understand the history of the Australian Constitution. The background to the Australian Constitution, why we as a people are lumbered with a document with no explicit values, aspirations or rights, considering how it was formulated. Now, as I said before, this program is pre-recorded, and if you're expecting an analysis of what's happening in the world today, you'll need to listen into the Anarchist World This Week next week, because I'm having a break. Well, it's not really a break, but I need to speak to a number of people regarding a number of issues, and obviously I won't be around this week. So, how did it all begin, Charlie? Well, we all know It's Charlie and Anne, I should say. We all know that the colonisation process began in earnest on the 26th of January 1788, when the British Empire set up a penal colony at Port Jackson. Now, obviously, being enlightened people, we forgot that First Nations people, both on the continent and the Torres Strait, had been living on this continent for over 60,000 years. Some people say 65,000 years these days. We forgot. And obviously we incorporated in our constitution, now we incorporated in our legal system the legal fiction of terra nullius, the land of no one. This land belonged to no one, although there are over a million people living on the continent when colonisation began, although there were horrendous battles between the colonisers and the original inhabitants, which led to the deaths, not just colonisers, but hundreds of thousands of First Nations people. The land belonged to no one. It wasn't until 1992 when the High Court, in a split decision of 4-3, in the Mabo case, found that the original inhabitants had rights to land in law because of their prior occupation of this land. And the fiction of terra nullius was rubbed out of the legal system. But interestingly, the reaction was swift. But that's something for another day. So, what we saw initially was the introduction of convicts who formed the backbone of the colony. And the colony of New South Wales, which was established in 1788. What we saw was the colony of Tasmania, established in 1803, after a failed colonisation journey at Sorrento in Victoria. They set up the colony next to brackish water. So they moved on to Hobart. So by 1803, you had two British colonies on the Australian mainland. You had Tasmania, you had New South Wales, which incorporated what is now called Queensland, what is now called New South Wales, and what is now called Victoria. We saw colonies established in South Australia, and it wasn't a penal colony, and in West Australia. Now, in 1847, Governor Fitzroy, the Governor of New South Wales, wanted an intercolonial authority set up. And in an act of Parliament in 1850, the British Parliament, because remember the British Parliament was responsible, they set up this authority. Didn't do much, but they set up the authority. Now, in 1851, the colony of Victoria was proclaimed, broke away from New South Wales and had its own self-governing entity. And in 1859, the colony of Queensland was proclaimed when it broke away legally, you know, from New South Wales through an act of the British Parliament. Okay, so you had these colonies now around the place. You had Queensland. You had Victoria, you had New South Wales, you had Tasmania, you had South Australia, which was responsible for the Northern Territory, didn't have an Australian Capital Territory, didn't exist, and you had West Australia. So you had all these colonies, six independent, self-governing colonies. Now let's not forget the effect that the Eureka Rebellion had on the British authorities. The Eureka Rebellion and the rebellions which had occurred in Canada highlighted the fact that these colonial societies, one, no longer wanted or required convicts, and two, that people wanted some level of government. And the Eureka Rebellion not just accelerated this process in Victoria, where you had a part where you had universal male suffrage incorporated into the upper and lower house, but also had a profound impact in the other states. So by the 1880s, you'd seen a number of premiers' conferences. You'd seen the idea of federation floated. And in the early 1880s, there was an attempt at early federation. But that fell through when the colony of New South Wales, the major colony, refused to be part of that process. Now, there were three pressing issues for the colonies. One was customs duties, and let's not forget that excise and custom duties. Each colony had its own custom duties. So trade between the colonies was restricted because of the custom duties which are actually levied on intercolonial trade. So there was this push to remove customs duties on the Australian continent. This is one of the driving forces for federation. Then you had the question of immigration. By the latter part of the 19th century, this idea had arisen in the Australian community of a white enclave in the Southern Hemisphere. And the fact that Aboriginal inhabitants had been consigned to the dustbin of history and were regarded as a dying race, as of no concern to the colonisers, their concerns were non-white immigration. And this was an important issue for the emerging labour movement. It was an important issue for governments. It was an important issue for most of Australia. And a white Australia policy, immigration, curbs against immigrations, against Asian immigrations, and we saw that with the anti-Chinese legislation. And in 1898, we saw legislation in New South Wales that even banned people of colour from other areas of the British Empire. They actually introduced a dictation test. So immigration was a significant issue regarding federation. And the third issue was defence. Because although each colony had its own defence structures, its own infantry, its own naval forces, as we saw in Victoria with the HMAS Cerberus, which was considered to be, the forefront in terms of battleships to keep the Russians at bay. And if you ever go to Melbourne and you find yourself down at Beaumaris, you can actually see the remains of the HMAS Cerberus sitting forlornly in the waters, but that's another story. And in 1885, we had our first inter-dominion kind of exercise where the government of New South Wales sent 770 New South Wales infantrymen to Sudan. That's right, Sudan, S-U-D-A-N, to avenge the murder of General Gordon. So that was the first foray into protecting the empire. So we had three, and obviously at the same time we saw a number of German colonies established in the Pacific. Although Queensland had incorporated New Guinea into Queensland as a colony, the Germans had incorporated Papua. The French were colonising, the Pacific at a rapid rate, so defence became an issue. So there were three issues which promoted the idea of having a federation. They were, as I said before, customs duties between the colonies, immigration, defence. Now, in 1989, I could be wrong here, it could have been 87, I think it's 89, the Premier of New South Wales, Henry Parkes, I refuse to use the word sir in front of them, all right? Henry Parkes, the Premier of New South Wales, he proclaimed at Tenterfield, and it's called the Tenterfield Address, the need for a united federation of Australia as the Premier of New South Wales. In 1891, we saw the first federation convention, which was basically a leaders-only affair, where the Premier of Queensland, Samuel Griffith, was entrusted with the task of drawing up a constitution. Now, in 1893, there was a little bit of a backward, a bit of a revolt amongst the rank and file, because most Australians or people in the colonies at that stage saw this, you know, this push for a constitution as something which was being pushed by a minority which had a powerful minority. So in 1893 at the Cowra, C-O-W-R-A, convention in New South Wales, what is described as the People's Convention, there were People's Convention, there were two major issues regarding the Constitution. One, the Cowra Convention, the People's Convention, rejected the idea that the 1891 Constitution, which had been written by, to a major degree, by Samuel Griffith, rejected that Constitution, saying they wanted a new constitutional convention which would be held with elected delegates, 10 elected delegates from each colony. And also, once the constitution had been drawn up, that it would have to be put to a referendum to the people of the colonies, the 6 separate colonies, to see whether they agreed with federation. This is the first time in human history that a constitution for a government, for a state, was taken to the people for ratification. And you would think that after 1893, People's Federation Convention in Cowra, where these two important issues were agreed on, the delegates should be elected from the colonies, 10 delegates from each colony, to attend a new constitution to create a new federation to create a new constitution. Now, in 1895, the premiers agreed to these demands. The premiers of the colonies agreed to this demand. And in 1897, there was a National Federation Convention, which was held in 3 parts over the year, which designed a new constitution. This constitution was then taken to the various states, where referendums were held on whether the colonies wanted to federate. I know it sounds pretty boring, but the important thing is, although it may sound very boring, it has profound implications for us in 2025. So, at the end of 1897, the new constitution, which had been formulated by the 60 delegates, the delegates from Victoria, Tasmania, New South Wales, and South Australia were elected. The delegates from West Australia were appointed by the government, and the Queensland Parliament couldn't actually agree on the enabling legislation which would allow its delegates to attend, to actually have an election for delegates. And it wasn't until the third session in late 1897 that the Queensland Parliament agreed to send delegates to the Federation Convention. Now, at the first round of referendums, the people of Tasmania overwhelmingly voted to federate, about 95% voted. The people of Queensland didn't vote. The people of Victoria overwhelmingly wanted to federate, about 90%. The people in South Australia overwhelmingly wanted to federate, about 80%. But the people of New South Wales didn't reach the quota, which was 80,000, was the quota for federation. I think it was about 74,000. So the referendum, the first round of referendums in 1898, failed in New South Wales. Now, that was the major state. So what happened next was there was a twigging of the constitution by the premiers. There was another round of referendums, late 1899, and by a majority of about 70% to 30%, the people of five of the colonies, excluding West Australia, decided to federate. Now, interestingly, the elections that were held on the referendums were non-compulsory, so many people who were eligible to vote didn't vote, and obviously each state had its own rules regarding who could vote. And let's not forget that apart from South Australia and West Australia, no women were involved in the vote for the elected delegates. And no women were involved in the vote for the referendum, apart from South Australia and West Australia. Now, people of colour and Aboriginal people in Queensland were not able to vote unless they owned land. People in Tasmania were not able to vote if they were receiving support from the Tasmanian government, so the poor weren't able to vote. So only about, I think it was about 750,000 people actually voted, but 70% voted for federation. So what happened after the constitution was kind of altered by the premiers? It went back to New South Wales, and there was support for federation, about 60% for, 40% against. So the bill then went to England, because the funny thing about the Australian Constitution is that it was actually enacted by the British Parliament, and five of the six states went to England to promote the idea of a constitution and steer its passage through Parliament. West Australia was not involved because they hadn't been able to agree on a referendum. Because West Australia was quite interesting. Between 1890 and 1900, about 150,000 people flocked to West Australia looking for gold. So they increased the population from 50,000 to about 200,000. Those people that flocked to the gold fields were considered to be outsiders by those people who had been created farms in the area. These were the sand gropers. So on the night when the British Parliament passed legislation to adopt the Australian Constitution with some amendments, including an appeal to the Privy Council, only on the 9th of July 1900, only Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia and Tasmania were part of that federation.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
On the 20th of July 1900, the people of West Australia finally had their referendum and they voted, I think, 70% for and 30% against federation. So if you look at the preamble to the Australian Constitution, it's quite fascinating. There's no mention, obviously, made of First Nations people. There is also no mention made of West Australia. Because when the British Parliament had voted to approve federation of the Australian colonies, the West Australians were not part of that delegation. So that's an interesting trivia question for you. You know, who's not in the preamble? West Australians and, you know, First Nations people. But it gets even more fascinating. In 1933, the West Australian people, having a little bit of buyer's regret, voted to secede from the Federation. But the Australian Federation refused to accept their secession. So they went to the British Privy Council. They had an appeal to the Privy Council in 1933. And the Privy Council found against secession for the West Australians because in 1931, the British Parliament had passed an act which denied them the ability to interfere in their former colonies' internal machinations. Fascinating. Let's get back to the Federation. So, on the 1st of January 1901, in Centennial Park in Sydney, the Duke of Cornwall, that's the George V later on, opened the first Parliament. Big celebrations. Federation had occurred. Wonder, wonder, wonder. But there was only one problem. When you looked at the articles, when you looked at the different sections, there were no explicit values, rights, or aspirations in the document. You would think a document which had gone through a number of constitutional conventions, which had elected delegates to create the documents, which had gone to a referendum of those who were eligible to vote, would have something in it. Something in it. To actually have, it would have some explicit values, aspirations or rights. Now, when you look at the Australian Constitution, and this is where we come up to 2025, quite closely, and you don't have to be a constitutional lawyer to do it, it's a small document, easily read. You can pick it up anywhere, you can take it off the net for nothing. It's an extraordinary document. See, what happened in the conventions is that, although there was an emerging women's movement, the suffragette movement, which was quite strong, and an emerging labour movement, which was quite strong, of the 60 delegates, only one was part of the labour movement, and there were no female delegates, although women in South Australia and West Australia had the right to vote. No female delegates. And the primary reason for federation, as I spoke at the beginning of this sector, were the fact that they were concerned about non-white immigration. They were concerned about defence against Germany, Russia, the French, who were taking an increasing interest in the Pacific. And they were concerned primarily about custom duties between the colonies. And let's not forget the 1893 People's Convention in Cowra was actually called by the Riverina border groups who their major concern was excise. And those sections and those small number of delegates who wanted to raise the rights of female suffrage, let alone Aboriginal suffrage, and who wanted to raise the rights, wanted to incorporate rights in the Australian Constitution, were voted down. So when you look at the Australian Constitution, which theoretically protects you and me, the fact from the arbitrary exercise of state power, the fact is it is essentially a document which regulates the relationship between the six colonies. Now, Australians somehow think that they have freedom of religion, Sorry, somehow I think, my apologies, somehow I think they've got freedom of association. They've got the right to strike. They've got the, you know, the right to freedom of speech. The right to protest. We all think we have all these rights. Now, there may be some common law element to these rights, but there is no protection from the, for the individual from the arbitrary exercise of state power in the Australian Constitution. It is basically a document which regulates the relationships between the colonies and the central government, the new federal government. Nothing else. And let's not forget, the first act which was enacted by the new Australian Federation was the White Australia policies, and only one person voted against the White Australia policy in the new parliament, either in the House of Reps or the Senate. So the primary aim of the Constitution is to regulate that relationship. The individual is of little concern. Although under the current constitutional arrangements, you have freedom of religion and you have the freedom to be tried by a jury for an indictable offence and you have the freedom for just compensation if your property or land is acquired by the Commonwealth government and you have the freedom not to be discriminated against depending on the state you were born or live in. That was very important during Federation because discrimination regarding on state boundaries was a critical part of the colonial process. There is no freedom of association, no freedom of speech, no freedom to strike. There's nothing. As far as the Western powers are concerned, the Australian Constitution provides no protection for the individual from the arbitrary exercise of state power. Now, this is critical. This is critical in 2025. As we see more state governments and the federal government passing legislation to restrict our ability to associate, to protest, to talk. Critical. Because of all the Western nations, we have the least protections for the individual from the arbitrary exercise of state power. Even less than good old Mother England. It's extraordinary. So what that means is, in a practical sense, that if you have a majority in both houses of Parliament, you can pass any legislation you like. That's right. You can pass any legislation you like at any time for any reason. And if you think I'm making this up, think of what's happened in this country in the last 40 or 50 years. Think of how the trade union movement has basically been destroyed. And it's been destroyed legally. You don't have the right to strike except inside an enterprise bargaining agreement period. There is no right to strike. There is no right to withdraw your labour outside an enterprise bargaining agreement period, whether you're a member of a union or not. It is a criminal offence under legislation. And you can be fined up to $10,000 a day as an individual for exercising the right to strike, which doesn't exist under legislation. Let's look at freedom of speech. The High Court, in its judgment in 1996, decided, although there was no explicit right to freedom of speech in this country, there must be an implicit right to freedom of speech during an electoral, a federal electoral period in order for an election to occur. Because if you don't have freedom of speech during that period, how can people make up their mind about what particular group, independent or political party they will support? Think about it. What political party will they support? How are they going to get anywhere? Who are they going to support? So the High Court in its wisdom had to find the implied right to freedom of speech during a 4 to 6 week period every 3 years so that an election can be held. Now, those of you who think there's freedom of association, think again. After the 9/11 outrage, the Australian Parliament was panicked into passing a series of legislation which is the most draconian in the Western world. If the authorities, and I'm talking about the ASIS, Federal Police, think you may inadvertently have information that may assist them in their investigations, you can be kidnapped by the authorities, held somewhere for 7 days. During this period, you can be questioned. If you refuse to answer questions, you can be jailed for up to 7 years. Now, you can be involved in a criminal case. You could be a drug lord who's imported $1 billion of meth, which causes extraordinary damage in the community. And you can say, no comment, no comment, no comment, no comment. All right? Prove the case. All right? That's a criminal activity. But if the authorities believe you inadvertently, you may have knowledge that may assist them in their investigations in some type of, you know, political activity, well, then you can be picked up off the streets, held secretly in some jail, questioned for up to 7 days. And if you don't answer questions, you can be jailed for up to 7 years. And if you've got no information and decide you're just an idiot like you and me, they chuck you out back on the street, you can't tell anybody that they have arrested you and held you in secret for 7 days and questioned you. And if you do, you can be jailed for up to 7 years. Now, I'm not making this up. This is in legislation. And it gets better. It gets better. If the Home Affairs Minister, it used to be the Attorney General, I think it's the Home Affairs Minister, believes that the group you're associated with may pose a threat to Commonwealth property or interests, that group can be banned immediately by the Home Affairs Minister, and anybody who attempts to collect money for the defence of those members can be jailed for up to 25 years. Again, I am not, you know, making this up. It's there. Extraordinary. Now, I remember in the 70s, occupations were a legitimate form of protest, especially in industrial, you know, disputes. Today, if you're involved in an occupation, you can be jailed for up to 25 years. And let's not forget that about over 20 years ago, the High Court found that under Australia's constitutional arrangements, that if you're an asylum seeker or refugee, you're not a citizen of this country, you could be jailed indefinitely for the heinous crime of requesting asylum. So those of you who think that you have constitutional protections, think again. The Australian Constitution has no values, no explicit values, no explicit aspirations, and no explicit rights. And I'll repeat it again. No explicit values, no explicit aspirations, no explicit rights for the individual or for organisations. Parliament can at any time it likes pass legislation to restrict your ability to protest. In many regards, although much of this legislation has not been enacted, it is on the statute books. But what is more worrying is the increasing level of state legislation and Commonwealth legislation which is criminalising legitimate protest activity. Over the last few years, we have seen environmental activists who use direct action being jailed in this country. So don't tell me there are no political prisoners in this country. We are seeing the passage of draconian legislation by state authorities and to a lesser degree currently by the Commonwealth authorities to limit the ability to protest. Those of you who are old enough will remember the good old Bjelke Petersen days where you couldn't have more than three people gathering. It could be broken up and you could be arrested and jailed. But the difference is the penalties have increased exponentially. We're talking about penalties which take away 25 years of a person's life for the simple act of protesting, for the simple act of opening your mouth. And we are seeing now more and more legislation come into place which restricts freedom of speech. I'm not talking about hate speech. That's a different matter. I'm talking about freedom to express your ideas in this country. Because ultimately, we're not aware of the air we breathe until it's removed. And then we realise the issues that we face, life-threatening issues. It's the same with the Constitution. And the Australian people, to a significant degree, have been lulled into a false sense of security regarding their constitutional rights. We look at China and we go, tut, tut. We look at North Korea and we go, tut, tut, tut. We look at Russia and we go, oh my, you know, my deity. But the fact is, although we claim to be a democratic society, the fact is that the majority can do what they like. You can pass legislation legally through Parliament, that two-year-old, blue-eyed children are the spawn of the devil and they need to be incarcerated legally. And that's a great dilemma. You, under our particular legislative framework, whenever we pose a threat to corporate interests or whenever we pose a threat to the government of the day, we find ourselves in a situation where we are marginalised and criminalised and potentially face significant jail time for standing up for ourselves, for the rights of the people around us, standing up for reform and change. When you saw the kerfuffle a few weeks ago regarding the permit which was necessary for the Gaza, for the people who are involved in the Palestinian Gaza protests, you can see how authoritarian tendencies are beginning to take hold in this country. It's very easy through social media and the legacy media to create a climate of panic and fear and anxiety in the community to suit short-term political goals and short-term political goals. It's one thing creating that panic. It's another thing having a legislative framework which allows governments to criminalise and punish people as a response to that artificially created panic, and we see it across the country currently. Now, obviously, there are increasing problems in our society because of increasing inequality, because of increasing insecurity, because of increasing fears that we face regarding essential, you know, services. But the fact is that constitutionally we have no protections. Now, I remember in 1999, that's right, 1999, when Mr. Howard, in an attempt to destroy the Republican movement, held elections for a constitutional convention. Now, I and a colleague stood in Victoria on the platform of a new constitution for a new millennium. That's right, 25 years ago. We garnered a miserable 5,000 votes. Although every elector was able to look at our program because of the way the voting was held. 5,000 votes out of a possible 3 million votes. A new constitution for a new millennium. But the fact is that in 2025, we are faced with exactly the same problems. We are saddled with a constitutional framework which is not fit for purpose. Not fit for purpose in 2025. A constitution that has no values, no aspirations, no explicit rights for the individual outside the freedom of religion, the freedom for just compensation if your property is acquired by the state, the freedom to be judged by a jury for indictable offence, and the fact that you can't be discriminated against but regarding on the where you live, which state you live in. The list goes on and on. But there's no other freedoms. Unfortunately, every attempt, or almost every attempt, to change the constitution legally has been stymied by the constitutional framework itself. If the constitution can only be changed when the government, which has a majority in both houses of parliament, sets a question for the people. There's no citizens initiated referendums in this country, as there are in Switzerland. The only questions that can be put to the people are the questions that can be put to the people in a referendum by the government of the day. And in the majority of cases, these referendums are based on the centralisation of power in the hands of the federal government. So no wonder the great majority have failed. Not only do you need the government of the day to sponsor the referendum and have the power to determine the wording in the referendum, you need a majority in the country as a whole and the majority of states. So as we saw with the attempt to change the constitution to give First Nations people a voice to parliament, we can see the issues that arise in terms of changing what is a moribund document which has nothing to do with 21st century society. And this is a continuing issue. As more and more issues are raised in this country, as more and more people not only become dissatisfied with the way they are treated and the way they live, as inequality grows, the fact is that governments at the local, state and federal level will face increasing resistance to their legislative agenda. An agenda which in the majority of cases centralises power and allows wealth to be accumulated by a shrinking minority in this country. And when you have constitutional arrangements which allow the government of the day to introduce draconian legislation because there is no protection for the individual from the arbitrary exercise of state power in society, you have major issues. And as we see the introduction of artificial intelligence, as we see more and more people lose their ability to keep a roof over their heads and feed their children because they are no longer needed or wanted within the wage system, we will see an increasing number of people turning to direct action and activism, which goes beyond casting a ballot every 3 years in a federal election, which means they will take their concerns to the streets, which means there'll be more dislocation in society, which means that people will demand reform, as they've done at every other time in this country's history, when things go backwards, and they are going backwards currently for the great majority of people in this country, especially younger people. When you have governments which have unlimited constitutional powers to derail protest, to criminalise protesters, to jail people for what they say, not what they do, you begin to realise that we are faced with major issues in 2025. As the pressure for reform increases, the reaction of the state will become more authoritarian. And as that reaction becomes more authoritarian, we will find that more and more and more Australians will find themselves at the sharp end of the law, not because they promote violence, but because they are promoting ideas which will have an impact on that small section that owns the means of production, distribution, exchange and communication, which will have an impact on the corporations which determine our current parliamentary agenda. And this is a dangerous place to find yourself in. We like to think of ourselves as a freedom-loving people. But the fact is, we fail. We failed in the 1890s to introduce values, rights and aspirations into the founding document of Australia. We have failed in 2025 by not raising the issue of introducing a slew of rights in the Australian Constitution, because no government is willing to take this issue to a referendum, neither today or tomorrow. No government wants to limit its power. I've always been interested in the concepts of the citizens-initiated referendums, in the concepts of the citizens, not the government of the day, been able to change the constitutional arrangements to meet the challenges that we need to meet in 2025. That is the issue that we face on a daily basis. I encourage you to promote constitutional reform. It's not impossible. Thank you for listening to The Anarchist World this week on your local community radio station, courtesy of the Community Radio Network. This program has been streaming live on 3cr.org.au. The program is podcast. You can access the podcast by going to 3cr.org.au. This is a special pre-record. I'll be back next week to look at the situation around the globe. Thank you once again for listening to The Anarchist World this week.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.